Welcome to Liberating Libraries, an audio project by the Conspiracy of Equality. In this series, we take a look at some of our favorite authors and ask how their works of fiction might inform, enhance, or guide our own thinking about the world and our activism. We believe that when done well, fiction foments invention. It is where we get to try our hands at being attuned to alternatives. Sometimes it fails, and it's always imperfect. But at any moment, it can be the source of solidarity, equality, and freedom. This time, we're looking at some works by Octavia Butler, The Parable of the Sower and The Parable of the Talents. Let's begin with a reading.
When a parent's stability disintegrates, as it must, God is change. People tend to give in to fear and depression, to need and greed. When no influence is strong enough to unify people, they divide, they struggle, one against one, group against group, for survival, position, power. They remember old hates and generate new ones. They create chaos and nurture it. They kill and kill and kill, until they are exhausted and destroyed, until they are conquered by outside forces. Or until one of them becomes a leader most will follow, or a tyrant most fear. Earthseed is Lauren's belief system that is revealed to her at a young age. While on the road during Sower, she begins to convert her fellow travelers to this religion. The most controversial part of it is the destiny. Because in her religion, there's no heaven or hell, the ultimate end of Earthseed is to take root among the stars, bringing Earthseed across the universe and leaving Earth for good. This for her is the destiny and the ultimate embrace of a God that is change. It's this movement forward that can galvanize us to reach for the stars, essentially, and go forward and become bigger and better. So, are we missing a destiny? Or are we missing a bigger picture? Do we need something like this to ground our movements, to be able to have them build and become something bigger than...
Yeah, this is a really tough one for me. Because I think it raises the problem for me that the destinies that we've constructed for ourselves in the past haven't been working out so great for us, right? The idea that we have a destiny to evangelize and proselytize around the world a particular religious form that, you know, takes us to salvation or takes us to preparation for judgment or preparation for whatever might be coming, has obviously come alongside an awful lot of violence. And I don't think that Earthseed is implying that there's violence connected necessarily to spreading the destiny, mm-hmm. but I worry about it because destinies don't seem to work very well for us, historically. I don't know if it's also only seeing destiny in terms of civilization is part of the struggle that I'm having, right? Like the idea that for so much of modern history, anyway, we've been constructing, the West has constructed this human destiny in terms of civilizing missions. Yeah. And those are obviously really, really violent and colonial and all of this terrible stuff happens with them. So for me, that part's really, really scary. You know, some of the basic things that we have been learning about in terms of leftist movements or in terms of alternative politics is that you have to provide people with tangible, meaningful changes to their life. You have to show people how we can live otherwise and how we can create alternatives that meaningfully affect their lives now, in order to build that movement or build that momentum, but build it towards what, right? Mm-hmm. I think that there is a cynicism that I certainly feel like I have, where as soon as somebody wants to talk about what we're building towards, I want to shut down because the revolution is it, you know, can justify all kinds of things and has been used to justify all kinds of things and silencing of people and silencing of alternatives. So, yeah, it's a tough one.
On the one hand, I actually really understand what you're saying about the outcomes and tangible outcomes to get people onto your side. And that kind of, like, gut reaction when people, like, try to talk about, like, something bigger, like, about the revolution or something to that effect, where it's just like, come on, guys, let's just focus on what we're doing now. But that being said, I don't even know if, like, revolution is necessarily a destiny is enough. And I guess, like the thing that I liked about Earthseed is that it almost feel like some type of, like, spiritual gap that I feel misses and does not exist on the left. Because I feel like asking for outcomes and tangible goals is good, but it doesn't necessarily build community.
Hmm.
And it's good, but it's just like, okay, once we get those outcomes and goals, then do we just kind of, like, step back and people go back to kind of their lives around them? Whereas, like, or do you need some sort of, like, cohesiveness that comes from something other than just, like, you know, a Marxist politics or just, you know, like, struggle that can cohere people together and understand something together? Like, the destiny of, like, oh, we just need to reach the stars, like, I kind of felt was a little hokey and, like I didn't really enjoy it, but I do wonder if there is something like that is missing from social movements, and that to really become some type of critical mass, there needs to be something like that.
Yeah. Octavia Butler is a Black woman writing science fiction. So a field that's dominated by our perception that science fiction is written by white men. And one of her early essays was a response to a panel or a set of articles talking about how we didn't need multiracial characters, diversity in science fiction, because we can get enough of the metaphors of racism or racial tension through having aliens, that the alien stands in for any discussion of racism. And she responded to this saying, well, that's stupid.
Yeah.
Of course we need, like, the diversity of humanity to be represented in science fiction. And of course, the difference between having two species meeting each other and having two people within the same species who have been divided by these historical constructions of race,
mm-hmm.
is two completely different things. And I thought that was really interesting because it feeds into a lot of the way that the book is structured in as an anti-racist work, right? In the sense that both she's a Black woman writing in a male, white male dominated field, and because she specifically foregrounds people of color as the main leaders. And she makes a clear point that part of the building of community that Lauren does is in contrast to the racial divisions that are still existing in the society, in the America that she lives in. But she doesn't talk a lot about colonialism. Yeah. In fact, hardly at all. There's a brief discussion at the beginning of Sower when her father is teaching her survival tactics, when he mentions, you know, we eat acorns because Native Americans ate acorns, and people don't see this as food, but if we think about how indigenous people survived on this land, you would have to eat acorns. And so she mobilizes some of that knowledge, but she doesn't ever actually talk about colonialism. There's no real discussion of imperialism,
no.
in the sense of, like, what is America doing in the rest of the world, or how did that contribute to mm-hmm. the situation we're in? And there are no indigenous people in the book. And that to me was always, like, a little bit of a sticker, right? Getting me a little riled up as I was reading it, because, well, okay, so in any event, there are always indigenous people with us. And you can't have an America without indigenous people in it. I'm not comfortable with the idea that Indigenous people, in the event of a collapse, aren't going to have their own responses and their own alternatives to this, because there is a powerful history and a powerful cosmology and set of movements that come out of different experiences and come out of the fact that, like, genocide and collapse is not actually all that new for colonized people. The absence was striking. And I don't want to put it all on Butler as if it's like, oh, well, it's a bad book because this was absent, because it's not. But in a tale of post-apocalyptic America, its absence is striking and I think raises some challenges for the politics of Earthseed as a colonialist movement often, yeah. Or almost.
Almost, yeah. Yeah, I agree. So I guess I think the imperialism bothered me less so, but like the colonialism thing got me too. Because like, yeah, when I read that question, I was just like, yeah, I think the only thing I can think of was exactly the acorn and cactus, the foods that they could eat. And you're right, it's like, it's such a stark absence, as well as even the colonial ideology, just it's not challenged within the book. So, you know, their destiny is to go and, you know, teach people Earthseed. She had to call their ship the Christopher Columbus.
And she's not happy about that.
Yeah, she's not happy about that. But at the same time, it's just she doesn't actually challenge it.
Mm-hmm.
Or like it's not challenged within a discussion of like what this means for the Earthseed. Or like why we would still do that if we have this history of like the Christopher Columbus being a good thing. Yeah, I think that's the most frustrating part of the book. It's just like the complete absence of colonialism and indigenous people. There are a lot of reserves in California that, like, clearly something else is going on there, right? Like I can't imagine, like, let's get real, reserves have been facing collapse since colonialism. I think they might have a better way of understanding of, like, okay, now this is what we need to do and how do we go forward.
Mm-hmm. Or there would at least be some kind of solidarity to be drawn out there.
Yeah, yeah. Or, like, yeah, some type of conversation would happen.
It's an odd view of California.
Yeah. It's I think the weakest link, one of the weakest links within the book is its lack of colonialism.
Mm-hmm.
Particularly in Sower, there is almost like an obsession with guns within it. So right when they're in the community, her father is very insistent that everyone learns how to shoot a gun, how to aim a gun, how to use different types of guns. And then once the community falls, there is then this rush of like, okay, I need a gun. I need ammunition for that gun. Okay, we need better guns. Okay, we need more ammunition for these guns. Everybody needs to learn how to shoot these guns. And it was so strange. And like, because it's like, okay, as somebody who like, you know, when I'm around like a hunting rifle, I'm uncomfortable, much less a handgun or like some type of like actual like thing that's used to kill people, like I get uncomfortable. And then like within this book, which is really good and exciting, and it's just like, and trying to build this kind of new world and new ideas, it's still like we need to have guns, we need to protect ourselves, and we can only protect ourselves through guns. And I was just wondering like how you felt about that. Like, what did you think about that narrative within that book? Or does it pose any challenges necessarily to you? So I guess, okay, my questions that I actually asked were, so like, could they exist without guns? So like, could Lauren and her band of folks exist on the road without guns? Is there a way that they could have done that? Or could we imagine other ways of organizing in a collapse that would not have to be so obsessed with protection through guns?
Yeah, I thought about this one a lot. It's tough because I agree with what you're saying about the discomfort of the obsession with guns.
Yeah.
And then in Talents, when they get that crazy armored vehicle and the maggots come, yeah. And it's just like, oh my God, like who thought of designing these things, right?
Yeah.
And I think in the end I come back to, okay, what's the actual story? What's the actual narrative? And thinking, in the world they live in, yeah, they need guns.
Yeah.
Right? I don't actually think there's any way to live in that world without protecting yourself with guns. And I think that, you know, they're trying to be very smart about it in the sense of this is about self-defense and this is about, you know, she gets very angry with her older brother Keith when, you know, in the way that he sort of goes out into the world and then shoots somebody who doesn't have a gun because he has a gun and he can take his money, and like that's really, really bad to her. And I think that is important because, yeah, in the world that they create, how on earth? And it's also a very useful reflection, I think, for us to take seriously, because with the level of violence there is in this world, with the level of oppression and exploitation that people are under, do we really think that when these systems collapse, or if these systems collapse, we're going to be able to trust people not to kill us?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Yeah.
And as much as I hate guns, as much as I agree with you that guns are not an answer to any political problem or any emotional problem you cannot solve with a gun, I also think that you know, our world has created a kind of violence in us that, I don't know, we're probably going to need the guns.
That's really depressing.
It's super depressing. And I hope that, you know, that Earthseed doesn't build better guns, right? Yeah. Right? That part of the technological purpose of Earthseed is not to build better guns.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe I'm just really cynical or pessimistic about this, but I actually agree with Octavia Butler's interpretation of where we would be,
yeah,
in the world. Because, and it's not because people are inherently violent. It's not because human nature makes us want to kill each other. It's because we are so fucking oppressed and exploited, yeah, and violence is everywhere.
And for a lot of people, violence is the only thing that we know.
The only thing you know, and the only thing that's going to save you, right? Yeah. The only thing that you can use to stay alive.
Yeah.
And again, it's like, we're like Lauren in that way. We're living in this walled community where we don't have to think about violence. Like, even in our city, we don't have to think about the violence that exists in our city the way that other people in this city do.
Yeah.
And so it's a really, I think, it's a punch in the face, right? Like, it's a punch in the privilege.
Yeah. Yeah.
But do I think that, you know, the world we should construct should include guns? Absolutely not, yeah. Obviously.
Like, I think also, like, the other part about Sower was the first half is everything is fine, right? Like, everything is not fine, but at the same time, it's just, like, they're living within their walled communities. It's safe. Like, her father has a job, even though he has to go out and, like, from time to time. But it's just, like, there's just, like, a slowness about the collapse. And then it just kind of collapses all of a sudden. So it is. It's kind of like you're saying, where it's just like, no, climate change is going to be so much worse than that. But, like, so are we kind of, like, living in this walled community right now just before this collapse is going to happen?
Mm-hmm.
Without necessarily wanting to engage or realize it. I think, yeah, that was a part that really stuck out to me as well and really kind of scared me.
Yeah, it's interesting to think about whether the walled community, because you could read the walled community in California as, well, there are actual walled communities that exist, and people are increasingly building walls and gates around these secluded, protected spaces where affluent people get to live. But is it also just a metaphor for the fact that there are so many of us who live outside of walled communities but aren't living in the kind of collapse that people all over the world are living through right now?
Hmm. Yeah, I hadn't thought about it like that.
So both books are set in a world where ecological and social crises are leading to increasing violence and especially rising fascism. Particularly at the end of Sower, things feel like they are slipping into even more chaos. But in Talents, life is supposed to be improving in at least some ways. So crime is going down and the economy is slowly rebuilding. And this is happening despite the election of an authoritarian religious extremist and the outbreak of a war. And I felt like this wasn't really explained. And I wondered if it was a cop-out, you know, to move the narrative forward, or if it actually challenged the idea that it's people, workers, and resistance to oppression that are what make things better.
I don't think it's anything like that. Like, I don't think it's a cop-out. I don't think it's a challenge to my politics or a narrative thing. It's just, like, it's kind of a depressing answer that I have. People are organizing in that America. It's just fascist organizing that's moving it forward, right? So you have the, like, yeah, the Christian Church of America is creating all of these new, like, missions and is going out and helping people and providing food. So in that sense, there are, like, jobs that are going to be created, as well as you have that war, right? And war creates jobs. So it's not necessarily like that better is the right word, but I think stable. And like these fascist things would create a level of stability when there wasn't a level of stability. It's really depressing to think about because, you know, you do want to say, no, it's going to be the workers and communities who make things better. But it's just like, I don't think that's, I think that's not always the case. And historically hasn't been the case. It's a lot of things. It's number one, the dynamic of capitalism and of the booms and busts. It's the right wing being able to respond to people's needs as well. That can create stability. Mm-hmm. And like, it doesn't get better because clearly when they get trapped and like held under slavery with Jared's Crusaders, right? Like, that's not better, but it's more stable as a country.
Yeah, that's a good response, I think, because I was sort of thinking about it as like, yes, it is a cop-out because it's, and but it's like a totally reasonable one because it serves the narrative of the story. Yeah. And like, obviously, it's a piece of fiction, so it has to have narrative and it has to go somewhere. But that's actually a really good answer. And like, I didn't think of it that way. But you're right, because that's the scary thing about fascism, is that it can create stability in ways that appear to be serving people's needs. Yeah. And appear to be serving enough people's needs that it gets enough support to keep going and to do things like, you know, genocide and slavery and all of these other terrible things. I found myself frustrated a few times, wondering where the room was for people to organize and demand accountability, demand what had been deliberately stripped from them. I felt that it challenged so much about the way I think about justice and the need to demand what's been lost. So I guess this led me to wonder what role the past and time in general play in Earthseed. And in a world that's so violent, how do you move forward, and how especially do you forgive? Earthseed, the books of the living. To survive, let the past teach you, past customs, struggles, leaders, and thinkers. Let these help you, let them inspire you, warn you, give you strength. But beware, God is change, past is past, what was cannot come again. To survive, know the past, let it touch you, then let the past go.
I mean, I think it poses a problem for justice and accountability, but at the same time, again, if there is nothing to hold accountable for justice, right, like, how do you invoke the past, right? Like, what do you do for that? Like, you need to understand and allow the past to inform what you're doing, but, like, you still have to go forward. we've got to change, and if we need to use kindness to kind of help shape and make change easier, you would have to forgive. You would have to learn how to forgive, because this is a person you're going to have to live your life with and work with. So, like, we have to figure out how to, like, take this change that has happened to both of us and figure out how to make it forward. So we have to learn how to forgive and move forward. And I think that's kind of what Earth City is trying to do, right? Where change is sort of that. Change is God. It pushes people in all these different types of directions, whether we want to or not.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we embrace that, and how do we try to make sure that these past injustices don't happen again?
For me, like, I do really like it. I like the sentiment of it, but I think it also speaks to me in the sense that I see the world in terms of linear time. But I know that that's not the only way of understanding time in the world. And it's not necessarily the only way to invoke time within political movements. I don't actually know if there's anything I can say about this, because it does speak to me on those terms, but I'm also aware that those terms are fabricated in a way, because we've created this idea of time as this movement forward. And I agree with the sentiment that the past can't ever come back, and so beware of people who say the past is going to come back, because what they're really doing is constructing violence in the here and now, justified on, you know, a false narrative of the past. It also just raises that question to me of, you know, there's diversity in time itself. I just wonder what it might look like if we took time differently, what God is change would look like.
Yeah.
So one of the most interesting aspects of both of these books is the identification of the main character as an empath or a sharer. And she's not the only one in the book. There are actually a lot of characters who have this condition. So sharers are people who have a psychological condition where they feel other people's pain when they see it. So if you see somebody being punched, you feel like you've been punched. And I found it really interesting throughout both of the books, seeing how Lauren, the main character, navigates what this means for her, both practically speaking and in terms of how it shapes how she sees the world. I'm thinking especially when she says kindness eases change, right? That there's a role for kindness to each other, not only out of some sense of goodness, but also because being kind to one another helps us navigate change better. And so she uses it a lot of times to think through how she wants to relate to people in the world, but then also her limitations, what she can and cannot do, and how she has to kind of struggle to both remain hidden sometimes for her safety and also make use of her empathy to kind of connect with people. So I'm curious about this, and I want to hear your thoughts. Like, what did you think about this, and what kind of places can it take us?
The example that I have of why I liked the sharer so much is you go to Doctor Who, and like one of my favorite episodes is with the Ood.
Mm-hmm.
And the Ood were like, you know, aliens who humans had found and were able to colonize and create into slaves. And in order to talk, they had like a little globe in their hands that they would light up, and it would say whatever they wanted to say. So through the course of the episode, it finds out that what the humans have actually done is like the Ood's brain was actually in their hand. So what they've actually done is basically like taken off a section of their brain and put this globe, and by doing that it has controlled them. The doctor's partner Donna loses it on the human corporation that has like enslaved these people, because the corporation was like, well, they were just so trusting and friendly, like we had to enslave them because they didn't put up a fight. Like, of course they didn't put up the fight. They have their brain in their hands, right? Like, they have to be kind to you because like they have to, because like they would die if they didn't. And I think it's like that kind of informed my reading of the share. Like, you have to be kind to people if you're going to feel their pain. There's so much of this, like, like meanness that we put up walls around each other, like, and it's just like, no, like, you can't do that. You have to, you almost have to trust if you're a sharer, because that's the only way you're going to live. And it just changes the way we treat each other, this idea that you would have to trust each other.
Mm-hmm.
Like, because to not trust each other means you couldn't survive.
Do you think that she is building enough of that alternative way of being human into the work that she's doing?
I want to say no until the end of Talents. Mm. Until she actually starts going door to door knocking. I don't necessarily think she is trying as much to create and foster that trust, because they don't really trust, because they're still trying to build the community. Like, they're almost trying to build another walled community that within that that's trust, whereas by going door to door at the end and, like, you know, asking people to, like, work for food, and then, like, taking the time to, like, talk to them about Earthseed or, like, drawing their pictures or things like that, I think that would build trust. And I think that's what she kind of does, is, like, forcing people to be like, no, the people who are coming to your door aren't just trying to kill you just because they're, like, out of work or unemployed. Or that, I think, is attempting to build a level of trust that she doesn't necessarily do within the first half of the book.
How do we do that? Like, how do we build that into the work that we do?
I know it's an imperative, and I think it's, like, any movement that we try to do is going to fail unless we can capitalize on it.
Mm-hmm.
But, like, Jesus, I don't really even trust people a lot of the time. And, like, it's hard to bring down the walls that we have built around ourselves to allow some type of, like, emotional connection. It's hard. And I don't have an answer on how we do it.
And it's not just that it's hard, it's also enormously devalued.
Yeah.
In our movement building, right?
Yeah.
Enormously devalued. And the knowledge that you might gain from feeling somebody else's pain or from having emotional responses to something is incredibly devalued as being actual knowledge, which for me is part of what's really interesting about Parable of the Sower, and why I really like the way that she comes to her sort of philosophy or religion is that she's coming to it through feeling the world in some ways. And in so many of her movements, we don't allow ourselves to do that. And we also devalue and sideline people who do. So making space for that, I think, is an important feature, because I feel like it would be such an important grounding for a movement to say, this is where kindness comes from. This is why we have to do it this way. And mm. and thinking about, like, all the other cosmologies that could relate to this kind of way of thinking, a lot of it also comes to, or is about, like, thinking about these connections, this interconnectivity, this interrelationality that has to be the grounding for understanding how we act in the world.
Thanks for listening to Liberating Libraries. We hope that our conversations have sparked some ideas or thoughts with you. We know that there's lots of different ways to read any book, and if you disagree or have a different interpretation, we think that's great. We want to thank Octavia Butler for giving us these wonderful works and for sharing her imagination and provocations with us. The music used here is Balmoria from their album All Is Wild, All Is Silent. You should check it out.